Obviously, I wasn't trailing off because I was listening rather than talking. But I was feeling like an unformed, like we were going into something that I don't know how to formulate into words. So yeah. What I do have is the liminalism. What the point of the podcast is, or one of the ideas behind it is that. I can talk about something without knowing what it is that I'm trying to say, and hopefully actually just the act of speaking will bring it into form. And I think this even relates to what I want to try and conceptualize. So, but it had to do with so ancestral possession. You know, who are we if we're not how we experience ourselves to be, if we're not just, you know, the identity that we identify with, if there's more to us than that, and we know that there is, you and I mean, who, you know, what is that? What does that consist of, that larger identity or that larger sentience or awareness or experience and so on? Well, at the very least, it's ancestral.
Mm-hmm.
Right, like we're the continuation of a vast ancestral lineage.
Yeah.
So, to a large extent, that ancestral lineage is being continued through our actions, and this really is hard to talk about. But so to some extent we're already ancestrally possessed, and that's natural to be ancestrally possessed, as in, you know, our genealogy, our DNA, with a continuation of a lineage, and our particular lineage was I don't know if programmed is the word, but whatever it was engaged in whatever its purpose was, you know, throughout the generations, we're going to pick that up. You're talking about Jesus, right? Jesus and the 42 previous generations, and how his task was to break the cycle.
Mm-hmm.
So, the thing that I don't know how to put into words was that, like, all of this numerology and all this, the way in which you're mapping a kind of algorithm that's been created and generated through the media and through history, or as history, or whatever it is, right? The matrix that we get born into. Now, obviously, that was created ancestrally, because, you know, who else is there? It was created by human beings, unless we're going to bring the aliens in.
Right.
Okay, so what I'm trying to get at is it's like a programming. It's like a secondary programming that's overlaid on top of our biological programming.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like an ancestral imposition or something. It's like, I'm just making this up as I go along, because it was just a feeling of what we were touching on with this Malkovich thing and being taken over and possessed and turned into dolls, that there's this, well, second matrix actually, there's this kind of etheric layer or astral layer to existence that controls or shapes or informs everything that goes on the physical level.
Yes.
Right? And it's so congealed, to use that word you used, it's been so coagulated by, I guess, human intention or something, some sort of perversion or distortion, that it's actually preventing us from being guided by, you know, the larger I don't know what actually we'd call that, the universe at large, or anyway, it's preventing us from being guided by our souls, let's say, because we've yes. got this astral gunk that's coming between us and our souls.
Right.
Because that would be the poisons that is put in us.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, just like I say, I'm just groping my way around this, but there's something about the numerological system that is, I guess it is back to the Matrix code. It's not like the value is in seeing that it's there. I guess it does have information, actually, but it's sort of paradoxical because the information is, it's like the Matrix can't tell us who we are. So the information, the code, and the numerology is useful because it tells us who we have been told to think that we are.
Right.
But once we see that, then it's completely useless. Yeah, I mean, it's the thing that we don't want to read, right?
Sure. Yeah. No, that I loved that. Actually, if it goes back to the first Kubrick movie, Fear and Desire, there's a early on that movie. There's a line where one of the characters says something like, "Once you figure out how a mouse trap works, you can use it as a springboard." And I kind of feel that sort of it sums up this whole thing about the algorithm. It's like we are in a trap, we are in a loop, we are in a maze, and that's sort of the formulation that I like the most, is a maze. But that once you figure out how it works, you can progress somehow. And I feel deep down that this algorithm is part of how it works. And the other thing I wanted to say, which is sort of a demonstration, I guess, is that, so in The Shining, the very end, the July 4th ball is in 1921, July 4th. And so at one point I was noodling around on Wikipedia and looking at that whole month and what happened in July of 1921 in terms of historical events of significance.
Right.
And one of them was, I think it was July 18th, something like that, was the first public use of the this tuberculosis vaccine, which was called the BCG vaccine. That's like, you can find it on Wikipedia if you look up BCG vaccine, which is amazing because BCG, translated to numbers, is 237.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of like the 237 vaccine, and that's one way I've formulated in my head also, as long as this trap or algorithm, is that this thing is like, it's some sort of spiritual, or actually don't say spiritual, but some form of protection in a way, consciousness, of the idea of the vaccine. I don't support vaccines, but quite literally anti-vaccine, but
yeah.
I think it's like a metaphor for this sort of, I don't like the word spiritual, but I'll use it anyway, spiritual sort of protection against whatever these forces that are gunking up our lineage and have been trapped. And, you know, who's done the trapping and who's done who's administering the vaccine? It could be the same thing or the same, just two parts of the same program, really. And that's sort of another thing about Kubrick, is that for a while Mark LeClaire really kind of put this one out there, that Stanley Kubrick as Satan, he's like quite literally evil, quite literally Satan himself. And I think I would probably modify that to say he's both Satan and Jesus, because it's like all part of the same whole, you know, of I guess it's sort of a pharmacon. The remedy is the cure,
the
poison is the cure.
Yeah, where the sicknesses seek the cure.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Well, I mean that's very basic and archetypal, because it's the same conundrum I faced with John DeRuyter. At first, I thought he was Christ, and I thought he was Antichrist, and.
Right.
in the end, what was liberating was seeing that he was just a man, and that these archetypes don't, I mean, they can possess somebody for sure, and there's voluntary ancestral possession. You know, is there other archetypes beyond ancestral fragments or ancestral egregores? Who knows? You know, my guess is no. My guess is it's just us, and that's all it's ever going to be, but that's just a guess. But in terms of like seeing, I mean, for me specifically with John DeRuta, having gone through that experience of is he God, is he Satan, and oh, he's just a man, that was a growing up process for me, and it was of course all about my father. Yeah, at a biological level. Now, I don't think that we're limited to biological organisms. We've obviously been, you know, talking about how and why we're not limited to that, but we are contained by that. The experience of this particular biological organism, you know, that we're contained within that as consciousness for now, anyway. And so it, in my opinion, anyway, it does kind of all come down to Mummy and Daddy, because as infant consciousness, we're pristine and pure and completely uncultured, and I would say, perhaps in a sense, without being too poetical, like as close to infinite as we get, you know, while still being incarnate, unless we get enlightened, which is the goal. If we're going to put a name on it, is to be as little children, you know, to return to that pristine state, but with some kind of continuity. I mean, without just obviously, you know, regressing to being an infant who has to, you know, then you'd be, a retard, to use the un-PC term. But yeah, that doesn't seem. I mean, that might be better than where we're at now. Who knows? But anyway, I'm kind of meandering a lot here. But the what you were saying about the vaccine, and there's something there, that spiritual protection. See, what I first thought of when you said that was, oh, that's like the constructed identity, the self-care system that Donald Cowshed writes about, because it does protect us, but then it becomes a prison.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's sort of the bar. Well, you know, you're seeing the bars of your own cage, rather. So you know you're in a cage, but is that better to know and be in the cage, or to not know at all?
Yeah, well, because infants are put in cribs, which have bars, and that is literally for their protection, and it's fine when you're an infant, because you might want to wander around, but basically everything is interesting anyway at that stage. So it's not as though you have a conscious sense of I'm trapped here and I want to get on the other side. You know?
Yeah.
But over time we do develop that identification with our bodies, and our image of our bodies, and so on, and then that protective, that self-care system becomes restrictive, and then we develop all kinds of, I would say, neurotic behaviors to distract ourselves from how restricted and trapped we feel, and they just reinforce the, you know, they gild the bars of the cage, and that's the cultural immersion that I've, you know, been addressing a lot in my writing, and you know how culture because it provides relief from the the oppression of our identities. It kind of works like a drug, and yet, in order for it to provide relief, it has to appeal to our identities, so it has to feed them as well. So then it's like heroin. It provides relief, but then we become ever more dependent, ever more trapped, kind of in the very thing that we want to get relief from.
Right, and that sort of goes back to that whole mousetrap springboard idea, that the prison is the culture, and the culture is, and that's when you look at the word media itself, and culture. You know, those two words are very related. You know, the medium is the substance in which you culture a protein or whatever. Mm. And so I definitely look at media as the like exactly that, a growth medium of some kind of consciousness or some sort of thing that's being cultured. And so it makes sense that this embedded algorithm, if there is such a thing, is primarily in the media, because it's in the trap, and it's how the media works. And if you look hard enough at it, it starts to, or with the right, you know, methodology, I guess. Have you ever had the feeling of losing interest in the thing you're saying as you're saying it?
Yeah. I stopped talking at that point. but it's certainly sparked an interesting thought in me, you know, before you did lose interest, which is, do you think that one of the things that you're trying to map is the way in which media and culture is becoming self-aware, is becoming sentient?
I think you could say that. I don't think I've ever really said it to myself that way, but that makes sense. Or it's the way, because ultimately I don't see the subject-object divide. I just kind of see all is one, I guess, ultimately. So the media is basically a reflection of us. So I think it might be a growth medium for us in a way, or whatever is we lost touch with. It's sort of spurring on that thing to kind of crawl out of the shell, which is hard for me to say because so much of media is really horrific, and it's obviously used as a program of control in so many ways, and it constructs these, you know, like our false identities. But again, I think that's, you have to look at it, you have to sort of shift the way you look, you have to acknowledge it, that that's what it is, and then start to look at it as that thing and to see what the components of it are actually doing to us. And that is where you start to generate your own kind of sense of self or identity.
Is that all? Well, let's see. How long do I have to wait here?
Yourself.
isn't it like, I mean, this is getting the image of Rosemary's Baby, of course. Something is coming to term through our culture. It's trying to incarnate and whatever, this ancestral egregore or this AI or whatever. You know, we can't know what the hell it is. But it seems to me that, like, the positive, which is what, I mean, you're saying all is one. Okay, fine. I mean, that's a concept that is kind of a truism as well, but it's not our experience, you know, that all is one.
Right.
And,
sure.
You know, one of my sort of motivations in uncovering the organized abuse and, you know, all of those programs of torture and abuse and rape and just the most horrific things that most people don't even want to think about, much less dwell on or try to understand, is because, well, if we're going to look at the world and see it fully, then, and if we're going to accept it, if we're going to reach a state where we can accept the world, we have to, we don't necessarily have to start, but we have to eventually get to the very worst stuff. And if we're able to accept and embrace the world, even with all of that, you know, I had a dream recently where I realized that I had to love Jimmy Savile, or I did love him. I don't know, it was a dream, so it wasn't linear rational, but there was something about Jimmy Savile and there was something about love, and I recognized that, you know, I must extend love to Jimmy Savile, or I am, or I do, or whatever. And those two things that don't belong together, you know, where my unconscious was putting them together side by side, and a sympathy for the devil, right? And I've always had that. I loved Frank Booth and Blue Velvet, so it's just a lot harder when they're real. But the, so this to me would be the positive. We're talking about that somehow culture has been spawned through human beings and their fragmentation, their denial of death and all the rest of it, and all the horrors that, you know, culture hides, but also that feed the culture and, obviously, you know, make the entertainment, even, you know, specifically the forms of entertainment we like are full of dark horrors, that it, I actually lost my thread there, but I know what I was going to say, which is that it's a mirror. Like, whatever potentially is being born, as horrific as it is, it could only come into existence through us, you know, through our own unconscious behavior. So it's like the unconscious is becoming conscious. That's how I view, well, let's say the apocalypse. Let's just keep it really familiar and archetypal, the whole narrative of Revelation and the apocalypse and the beast and the Antichrist. Obviously, it's a symbolic narrative, but at a certain level, as you yourself are exploring, everything is a symbolic narrative. Everything is part of a meta narrative, and so difficult to sum this up. But actually, funnily enough, I've said this about my work in the thrift store. I said it recently to my wife. The thing I like most about working in the thrift store is how much I hate it. Because I just feel really good afterwards, like, oh, I did that, you know, I showed up and I was triggered all the time and I wanted to shout at people and be hostile, but I managed just to, you know, stay calm and centered, and it just feels very kind of enriching in some way. I want to say character building, because that's a kind of Victorian ethos, and it can be, you know, there can be a horrible side to that, but it does feel generally kind of freeing. It does feel like it's helping me to let go of my own, of some of my own defenses, right? So yeah, in a larger sense, like if some of us are willing to really see the algorithm of human existence in all its horror and not flinch and not turn away, but not worship it, but not condemn it,
right?
I think that there is a real value in that, for, and again, back to the like the self-care system is there in place so that we won't see the horror. So if and as we let ourselves see the horror, even despite our internal guardian is screaming at us not to look and to, you know, let it possess us, you know, so that we won't have to see it or whatever, then the self-care system becomes slowly obsolete, like the more we're willing just to gaze into the abyss. And the more we see that the abyss is us, just to end on a poetic note.
Well done. Yeah.
I mean, it is, and we are, like, we are the abyss, and that, that is poetic, but it's also true. Like, you can experience that, sounds like, from your, well, I don't know, that's just my sense, and I know I do. Like, I've been running from that experience of the abyss my whole life, really, or my whole I can remember.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in the future, like, we know we're moving towards our death, and
right. Yeah. Well, I don't remember exactly what I was going to say, or if I even had something to say. I'm just sort of contemplating at the moment.
You can have big silences. They're fine.
Okay. Yeah. Good to know. I need those sometimes.
Speaking of abysses.
Right. Just pause to stare into the abyss for a moment.
It's tricky because sometimes it's like you're not going to say anything if you stop talking. Like, you know, they're never going to talk again feeling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, yeah. Leading, I guess our death is a big, something McKenna always, when he would talk about his time wave and the end of history and all that, he would say that maybe this is just the day that, you know, I'm going to drop dead. You know, this is this is just my sort of track. And I think that there's something to that, for sure. Birth and death are two. Well, one of the whole concepts in Kubrology is this thing that Sean has called the parent thesis, where you take one point in time and then you take another point in time, and they form a parenthesis, so you'd have two brackets basically, and whatever's inside, if you find the exact midpoint of that thing, you will find
the child. Sort of
the child, exactly. The parent thesis in the child. And so the most sort of primal version of that is birth and death, because that's what a life is. It's a birth and then it's a death, and in between. And then so one of the things I do a lot of is finding, looking at people, looking at their lifespans, and finding the exact middle. And that sort of tells you something, I guess. And I guess one good example is Kubrick himself, where the exact mid of his life came 1 week before the JFK assassination. It was November 15th of 1963.
Well, it's your birthday, isn't it?
Yeah, it's, well, mine is the 16th, so yeah. And I think it's sort of technically in the midnight on between November 15th and November 16th, because I don't have the birth time, but so that's sort of always interesting to me in the first place, is that, you know, that's, if we're saying that the birth and death of Kubrick is the parent and then the child is this point right before the JFK assassination, and then of course that whole thing with JFK and RFK 237, and so I think that is, you mentioned the Bible code as being like being able to predict when someone would die or when you would die, and then so in some ways I think that might be one of the first things Sean said to me was that I think I'm convinced that somewhere in here is a method for determining like your death, you know. Like, you can determine that somehow. I think it's a long way away from actually figuring that out, but that if you worked at it for a million years, you would probably figure that out at some point.
There was a film about that recently, a French film.
Really?
Yeah, it's about God and how God's daughter, I think it is. Yeah, she screws up his whole computer algorithm for the planet and releases the death dates for everyone on the planet. So basically everyone wow. knows when they're going to die, and they have a countdown on their cell phone.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Do you remember what it's called? I thought it was something interesting.
Unfortunately not offhand. I have to edit it back into the podcast once I've remembered, but I'll certainly tell you anyway.
Sure.
Once I figure it out, yeah.
The other one is that movie Knowing. I don't know if you ever saw that one with Nicolas Cage.
Well, it's one of the movies I hated most in all life, so.
I didn't particularly... Yeah. I mean, I you know... yeah, I don't blame you for that. But it has that same sort of thing where he... It's basically the same plot, you know. Time capsule, the series of numbers that he figures out is casualty count of all these major disasters, and then it ends with EE, which is everyone else, which is when the sun explodes and kills everyone. I found the ending of that movie very sort of disturbing in its sort of directness. But yeah, I mean, I think in a way, I think that's, it's sort of a sci-fi concept, but it's one I like to imagine that this whole thing is basically a way to avoid that fiery death. Like say we're here on Earth and that in 200 years the sun is going to let out an explosion and kill everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And that somehow the whoever is, whatever agency has sort of spun this whole thing such that the humans on Earth can see it coming and do something about it. Or you could say an asteroid or any kind of thing. That's just one kind of thought exercise, what if scenario that I like to entertain. But then that's sort of a, but you know, it's a metaphor for the individual's death as well. So I guess cheating death is the ultimate point of all this, maybe.
Well, I think it's the ultimate drive of culture, the denial of death. And I don't know how familiar I was with Castaneda and the old seers, but that was their imperative, was to try and cheat death. And then, of course, transhumanism.
Right. Which I don't support. I think that is the height of arrogance. However, I don't know, I guess I see a difference between living forever and like living a little bit longer, you know, so like not necessarily achieving immortality, but preserving what is here, not necessarily through an individual. I think the transhumanist thing is sort of like individual immortality rather than immortality of maybe information or whatever it is that we're generating. I don't know.
Well, two dreams are coming to mind now. One was a dream in which everyone on the planet knew that they were going to die, like some disaster was coming, and so basically the whole human race realized that we were all going to die. And the mood of the dream, I mean, the terror that ran through the populace was exponentially greater than just the combination of 7 billion individuals who knew that they were individually going to die, because it was the terror of recognizing that the whole race was going to be wiped out and that there would be no descendants. In the dream, anyway, I understood that there's something in us that biologically we can be okay with death, partly because we know at a biological, visceral level that you know, there will be descendants. I don't know if it means you have to have kids. Sure. I don't have kids. I'm too late now, so I don't know. You know, I don't claim to understand it intellectually, but that there was certainly what the dream signified was that the individual fear of death was nothing compared to the terror that would beset us if we knew that we were going to go extinct as a species.
Right.
The other dream I had was... this is the silver lining or not, a long time before, in which I I don't know how to put it, but I guess I experienced myself as consciousness that was had reached the end of the destruction of the physical universe, its reduction to nothingness, and that there was that this consciousness, or that as consciousness it was possible to continue to somehow make the leap from the end of all matter, where all particles were completely dissolved, to still be there when a new universe was created, but only if that consciousness had absolutely no content. Like it couldn't take anything with it. It wasn't the same as memories or something. It was much more subtle, but it was just if it could reduce itself to dimensions that were smaller than the smallest particle, then it could sort of slip through the hole that was created, you know, when the whole material universe was destroyed, and that this is the experience that consciousness has, you know, various periods throughout temporal existence, the universe gets completely reduced to nothingness, and then another universe is created, and consciousness does make that leap, but it doesn't take anything with it. So, I mean, I just bring those up. It's kind of random because they popped into my mind. But in terms of immortality, you know, like, I wouldn't. I once read a Patricia Highsmith novel. I really, really love Patricia Highsmith, and there was a passage in there where she said she didn't understand why people thought, you know, it was so important for life to go on and, you know, for humans to survive. Like when she imagined like the complete annihilation of everything and just total emptiness and silence, she found that much more comforting and much more pleasing.
Yes, yeah, I can sympathize there. I think, you know, day to day, I, you know, can feel that, and then some days I feel like, well, there is, or maybe the feeling of that I don't know why exactly, like, looking at the world today, I would have no trouble, I would not lose any sleep thinking that it was all going to end at some point, but maybe not knowing exactly what, maybe in the future, maybe there is something that needs to happen for some purpose that needs to be preserved. It's like it's sort of back to the birth metaphor. If you were female and you were having a baby and you knew that somehow you had some sort of future vision, that you knew that some accident or something would happen that would destroy your baby before it was born.
Like John Connor.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, pretty much. You would know, and you would have to. You would want to do anything you could to prevent that from happening. And so, if we looked at that on the scale of like the Earth being the mother or whatever, and giving birth to some the space fetus baby, you know, in 2001 or whatever, that needs. For some reason, it's not our place to know why.
No, right.
But that.
Yeah. So that's because that's. It seems to me that that's kind of self-counseling. Those sort of hypotheses. It's very Strieber-esque, I think. That, like, I mean, to the extent that we recognize, because Strieber, you know, he spins these narratives that are terrifying, and he in The Key, he writes about how it's possible that we will destroy the planet, and if we do that before we've managed to evolve beyond the planet, and he's even talking about space technology and shit like that, but anyway, we'll end up in limbo forever as a human species, because we won't be able to create new bodies. So basically he's come up with his own version of eternal damnation. He's Catholic. And that we've got to, you know, do something. He's going to have to write his books and persuade people that these are the stakes, and if we don't get our shit, you know. And that, it's, you know, to me, thank God, those sorts of premises are self-contradicting. Because if there's some divine purpose to existence, it can't possibly depend on human dependability. Right. Yeah, like we would have. Yeah, how long has the universe been here?
Right. Yeah, that's Yeah, I'm with you. And that's my sense, really, and how I, in that I don't, you know, people will the destruction of the planet, global warming, blah blah blah, and I kind of am just think, you know, it's gonna be fine. We've made it this far. I don't, the inexplicableness nature of the inexplicability of existence, sort of to me proves that it's all gonna work out. Like, if it was going to be over or be destroyed, it would have, it would already be destroyed. If you know what I mean.
Yeah.
That's how I feel about that. But you know, I you know, can never know. So that whole Strieber narrative kind of made me think. It's stuck in limbo. I'm thinking, oh well, we'll be stuck in the Black Lodge like Cooper.
Testing 1, 2, 3, 4. Jeremy Bernstein, tape, November 27, side A. Born July 26, 1928, New York City. My father is a doctor. One sister, Barbara, married. Two children. Lives in New Jersey, 6 years younger. Her husband is a lawyer. I was taught to play chess at the age of 12. But did not play seriously until about the age of 17, when I joined the Marshall Chess Club. And all our hearts are written with lyrical desperation. I don't think I read a book for pleasure until after I graduated high school. I had one thing I think that helped me get over being a misfit, school misfit, and that is that I became interested in photography about the same time, 12 to 13. And this is harder than it looks to carry more.
What the hell is this? Amateur night? Stop him, Harry!
Get him off that machine. That isn't a toy.
And time is nothing but a crook, haunting us as we get older.
Down to that moon, buddy!
Villains are always more interesting characters. It's very hard to make good people interesting.
And Billy!
Better to reign in hell than serve in heaven.
Get him off that machine, that isn't a toy.
And now we live in outer space, where the distance makes us colder.
Better to reign in hell than serve in heaven.
What the hell is this, amateur night?
Segue into maybe hitting on Twin Peaks, because I'm kind of curious what your more of your evolving thoughts on that, if you feel like
they haven't evolved, because well, I guess it's only up to six now, but I haven't even watched the sixth one.
Oh, it's seven actually.
Is it up to seven? Yeah, so I'm only up to five.
Gotcha.
So they haven't really evolved.
I recommend these last two. Just the last episode was. Well, I don't know. I actually forget that. I wanted to ask you what, because you said that part of it you liked about a fourth of it, or thought was good Lynch, as but the rest of it is bad Lynch. What was this? What are the good parts?
Well, I did an edit, so you can just watch the edit if you want.
I didn't.
Yeah, I linked to it at various places. So it was an edit of the first four episodes. It was definitely more than a quarter, because it was like an hour and a half long. So it was almost half of those first four episodes. But essentially, I like the dreamy, surreal Lynch. I don't like the goofy surreal, and I don't. And I like, you know, when he's telling a story. that's fine. Yeah. If he's actually telling a story, then even though I think he can be, he's a bit kitschy and whatnot, but yeah, I particularly like just the really, really intuitive, dreamlike stuff mm-hmm. that he does that is very, you know, visual and sound, and yeah. you don't feel like you have to figure it out, you know, or
right.
You can just enjoy it kind of at a sub-rational level.
Yeah, there's become this cottage industry now about trying to figure out Twin Peaks and all this mythologizing, which is sort of weirdly similar to my own thing with figuring out the meaning of existence, but mm-hmm. I do find it to be at its weakest when it's kind of schematic, trying to bring, like, there's this book that Mark Frost wrote called The Secret History of Twin Peaks, which is like a novel, which is basically taking the whole like 20th century conspiracy theory UFOs and sort of trying to tie it into the whole Twin Peaks narrative,
right.
which is fun and, you know, diverting, but it's also kind of I don't know, superficial in a way.
Opportunistic, maybe. It sounds like a pretty good marketing.
It is. Approach. It is. Although I can tell that he's like, he loves what he loves. It. He clearly has done a lot of research and is really integrating some sort of not the most well-known conspiracy stuff, but it's still well, that's something about the whole thing that interests me, actually, is that this notion that of Twin Peaks, where they say in the original series, see you again in 25 years,
yeah,
whether or not they were actually planning on it. And what I like, I think, the most about this new series is just that sort of the way he's sort of playing or they with time itself, almost like the faces of the actors, all these people have aged, many of them have died. It struck me on a sort of deep level where it's I don't know, it's very hard to put into words, but I do feel like, you know, like almost as if as a culture or as a society, we are where Cooper was, being stuck in that room, just sort of spinning our wheels and just watching everything decay.
Yeah.
And which then leads into like these kind of ideas that, which I'm sure you've thought about, that Lynch is tied into the control structures somehow, and is like, this is all kind of this sort of program unfolding, and that it's like not a mistake that now we have Twin Peaks and now Cooper is out of the lodge or whatever, and that we're somehow, you know, it's like time stopped for a while and now it's moving again, or I don't know if, you know, if that makes any sense.
Well, you have to believe that, don't you, because that's intrinsic to your thesis, that culture itself is a is being orchestrated, you know,
right,
holistically.
Right. Yeah. You're right. I kind of have to step outside of my larger box to sort of talk about this idea, but
I mean, couldn't it, but do you consider that, like, if we're in a Bardo realm of some form, I mean, that's a possibility. That would explain why we're still here, you know, after all these eternities. Then, I mean, this is going to come out a bit of a cliche, probably, because I can't think of a new way to say it, but then we would be generating the culture that we're fixated on anyway. It was like what would that be the equivalent of? Because it's not lucid dreaming, but we're studying the contents of our own dream without realizing that it's a dream.
Yeah. Totally.
And bringing back to that thing I was saying about how the organism doesn't ask why and it doesn't experience cognitive dissonance. I think the only cure for time is a spontaneous experience of the moment, or spontaneity. I mean, that, like, unfortunately, language doesn't capture it, does it? But that the moment itself is complete. Each moment is complete unto itself. It doesn't. It's not actually a continuation of the moment before. It's not leading to a moment after. It's not like a movie. Existence isn't like a movie. It's more like, well, I don't know if there's another, you know, metaphor for it, but it's well, it's non-linear. So just to finish the thought, that in terms of, you know, what's of value, like, for me, you know, finding out how fucked up the world is and how pernicious and toxic culture is and all those things, they don't diminish my experience in the moment. In many ways, they enrich it, I think, because they're helping me to let go of culture, perhaps. But essentially, what has value to me is landing in the moment. And I have this kind of, it's a bit of a belief, but if I could just, like, when we die, we enter into eternity, and so every moment becomes eternal, and so we only need one moment to live in for eternity, mm-hmm. as long as it's a moment in which we're 100% present. And so, you know, my fear is that I won't ever arrive in my life by the time I die.
Yes. Yeah. Another cliche or whatever, but that human history in the larger span of things is just a blink of an eye. And so in that kind of sense, I think about this as, it all is one moment, and the only reason that we think of it as not being one moment is this, the calendar, really, and our imposed measuring tool for slicing up these moments
for into posterity.
Yeah, and so, and yeah, the ways in which we repeat ourselves and our lineage. Like, for example, my dad died last year, and I'm sitting in what was his office, still has all his stuff in it, all his books and everything, and I did an interview with Robert Phoenix, who's an astrologer, and I told him about all this and how this correlates with my Saturn return, and he was basically just like, you've become the father, mm-hmm. you know, you've replaced him, and so it's like, it's bizarre how things change, but they don't ever really change in a way. I mean, it's almost a surface level shifting of things, but not the underlying substrate remains. It's just in different form.
Yeah, the thing that's of most value is the thing that can't be changed by time. So it's like the clutter of culture and of trauma and all the rest of it is the thing that, and potentially endlessly fascinating, but it's really the thing that we want to clear off the desk in order to actually be able to find the thing that we're looking for.
Yeah.
I used the metaphor of desk because it came up recently for me, but also because I'm sitting at my desk. But I don't know, did you inherit your father's desk?
Kind of. I'm the only one who uses it anymore. I've done all my podcasting here since it's become my office, basically, for this kind of stuff, although I haven't bothered to take any of his books out or anything like that. Well, I won't be living here forever, so that's probably why, but I forget what I was going to say. There's a whole bunch of strange things that synchronicities that occurred and around his death and all that stuff. And but I don't particularly want to go into it, actually.
That's okay. We're at the end of 2 hours, so then it would be the beginning of another whole other conversation. Yeah. If you did. So, yeah. But it's certainly a good, strong point to end on, I think.
Yeah.
Because we've been talking around it, we haven't talked much about our personal lives, really, but we've certainly sort of circled around the father.
Yeah.
Influence.
And the mother as well. Which is the other half of the equation.
Oh yeah, that reminds me, your parent thesis. Yeah, thanks for that. I was going to say more because it was really new. I'd never thought about the word parenthesis as parent thesis. Mm. And the notion that obviously two things give rise to a third. I mean, I'm aware of that. And the child, I don't remember now, but it definitely sparked some thoughts.
Yeah, I've found that to be an extremely useful concept in thinking about things, breaking things down.
Yeah, I know what it was. It was birth and death as our parents. That's a very interesting idea, right? Because, obviously our biological parents were necessary for us to be born. But if birth and death, we saw those as parents, they don't even meet in the temporal realm. So mm-hmm. So that would have to be a parenting of something else, mm-hmm. That was outside of time.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be the soul that is incarnating in the moment. So, yeah, in theory, I mean, to literalize your parent thesis, that midpoint of our life would be the point at which we land in our soul lands.
Yes. Yeah. So it's weird. It's sort of strange to think, you never know. I mean, have I landed yet? Am I?
Yeah, you still have time. I passed my sell-by date.
I'm maybe close. I don't know. Who knows what will happen? But yeah. It's a rising and a falling.
Mm-hmm. So you're 30 now.
I will be 30 in November. I'm 29 currently. Yeah. 30. I'm always interested in people's Saturn returns.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what was yours like?
Of course I thought about it. It wasn't really that striking.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it was a time that I was kind of building community, circle of friends and starting to write more seriously. Like I'd been writing for since I was 15 or something, but it was when I first got a computer, would have been around 27. And so when I guess the first books I wrote that actually became books, so I started Lucid View around 27 as well. So I guess that is significant in terms of it was time I really started getting into the role of writer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that makes sense.
Mm.
Sort of. I'm coming to see it now. It's like some people say you're not actually like an adult until you've had your Saturn return, which kind of makes sense to me. It feels like there's this sort of solidifying going on where just everything starts to seem more stark, I guess, and a little bit you start to see where you're going a little bit more, so that would make sense for you with writing and getting a computer. That's significant.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. correlation with the computer before, but that does, yeah. It's also, I mean, what you said about Stark, and that's a very Saturnian eyes. I mean, that would be, I imagine that's a good way to interpret Saturn return, is that Saturn is, as a planet, is its energies are bearing down on your consciousness, and so you're identifying with the Saturnian parts of your being, and so you're mm-hmm. seeing your own life through Saturn's lens, and that is a very stark kind of lens. It's, you know, it's really evaluating what your integrity and your intentions and
yes,
yeah, your maturity and responsibility and all those things.
Yeah, that's been my experience. Suddenly, I have a lot more. It's just not as just kind of carefree anymore. I have more to think about.
Yeah. I don't think I was ever carefree. I think I'm closer to it now than ever, probably.
Yeah, I don't know if I was carefree. I was carefree a little.
I mean, I was irresponsible and sure. Indulgent and all those things, but I was definitely worried. I've always been worried.
Yeah, I think it was when I started to get into conspiracy theory that I started to like begin to have anxiety. I was always anxious, but it was never really writ large until I started going down these rabbit holes, and then suddenly things changed. And my my friend that I mentioned earlier, it sort of sparked my move across the country, where I ended up in the Pacific Northwest. I left Indiana, which, and now I'm back after my father's death, but and I kind of lost touch with the friends I had made as I started to get into this different sort of perception of things. I sort of was just like, okay, the people I know aren't really, it's like I need something new, I need a new start, I need a new blank canvas. So I just kind of left and went somewhere where I really didn't know anybody. And now I met Erica, and everything sort of fell into place. So, I do feel like a lot like I'm kind of one thing this Cubrology has done is turned me into more of a determinist than I used to be. I don't really believe that. I don't know if I don't believe, but I don't see us having a whole lot of leeway in terms of free will. I feel like there's some pretty serious things influencing and pushing us in different directions, and we don't know why we make the decisions we make. Even if we make them consciously, we're still not sure why, ultimately.
Yeah, sure, yeah. I mean, I'm not deterministic, but I at the same time, I agree. I don't think we have much free will, and I think that the extent to which we have free will depends on recognizing that we don't have it.
Right.
And so then, to how to reconcile that paradox, I think it has to do with that we have a certain amount of choice about the quality of awareness that we bring to our actions, like how much we're... Mm-hmm. able to recognize that we're acting unconsciously, even though that won't change. We'll still do the actions will be the same, but our awareness of them will be different, and then over time we will act differently because of bringing the element of consciousness to it. So it's like we've got this tiny bit of wiggle room,
right.
But if you keep wiggling, eventually that moves the whole universe.
Yeah, I like that.